You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Author Michael Riordan's recent book, Our Way to Fight, Peace Work Under Siege in Israel-Palestine, is the work of several years of research and two trips to Israel and Palestine. In it, he documents the results of his encounters with more than 60 grassroots peace and human rights organizations. Michael will be speaking and holding workshops in several cities in BC this week, including in Vancouver on November 24th and 25th. He joins me on the phone now. Good morning, Michael.
Hello, Manuel.
So what prompted you to write a book on the subject of peace work in Israel and Palestine?
Most of my work for quite a long time has been an attempt to recover voices that are silenced or marginalized and to make spaces where they can be heard, because I believe that not only do they allow people or help people to find their own power, but also they complicate the official version. We all tend to hear the same rather loud official version on most things, and usually it's inaccurate, it's always incomplete. So my notion is that by seeking out the voices of people on the ground, as it were, who live the reality that the official version is pretending to represent, that we get a more accurate understanding of the way the world works and how to change it. In 2001, I met in New York at a conference, I met an Israeli anthropologist who became a friend and, in a way, my first trusted guide to the Middle East. She was in the process of moving from being an academic to an activist, and I sort of, from her, began to acquire a deeper and deeper interest in and concern about and what was happening in her country and Palestine. And as I learned more, I wanted to know more, and eventually it necessitated getting away from the books and the videos and going to see for myself. And that led to Our Way to Fight.
The title is quite interesting. What do you mean by peace work under siege?
Well, the book is about the difficult, increasingly difficult work that people are doing, have been doing for a long time, to try and create conditions in which it's possible for a just peace to grow in Israel and Palestine. Now, of course, that means the end of the occupation, military occupation, and it means a lot of other really deep changes. And as the Israeli government becomes increasingly isolated, it becomes increasingly repressive. It has always been so with Palestinians via the military occupation, but it is even now with Israelis who question the military occupation and the way Israel is dealing with the Palestinians. Those people are also increasingly coming under attack through a series of new laws. I just heard this morning that the Israeli government had forced the closure of an Israeli radio station that advocates peace. That's an Israeli station, perfectly legitimate, but they forced its closure. Israel tends to represent itself as the only democracy in the Middle East, but as far as I could tell, and from what I understand from people I interviewed there for the book, it seems that democracy really resides not in the regime, but in the people who are opposing the regime.
Your book deals with many personal accounts of the struggle against this very heavy state repression. Can you outline some of the examples that you detail in the book?
Yeah. Well, I traveled quite a bit, and I sought out people who aren't necessarily big names. I've always been interested in people who are leading what might, to the outside, seem like ordinary lives, except under the conditions they are extraordinary. For example, I talked to a young woman at the Freedom Theater in Jenin, in the Jenin refugee camp. There's this remarkable project that has endured invasion and occupation for a long time. It was started by a several people, including a Palestinian Israeli named Giuliano Meir Kamis, an Israeli actor. And its function has always been to help young people to find an outlet for self-expression and to learn to question and to question in effective ways through theater and allied arts, video, radio, photography, and so on. Anyway, I met this young woman, 22, Dana, who was at the Freedom Theater School, and I didn't have a long time with her because she was during break in a class that they were taking. But I was asking her questions about how she sees the world from where she is and what she hopes for. And the thing, she said two striking things to me. One is that I asked her what she wanted to change, what she wanted to accomplish. And she said she wants to change the way her country folk think, particularly about what girls can be permitted to do and boys, as she said, a girl can do nothing and boys can do everything. And she's one of only two female students in the theater school, which, by the way, insists on mixing the genders in all their activities. She said that she really wants to change that, which I respected a lot. The other thing she said is she wants people outside to know Palestinians. She said she sees the same wash of images from CNN and so on that we do, in which always Palestinians are perpetrators to blame for whatever happens, and Israelis are always the eternal victims. And that she wants to change, too. So that's one example of somebody who's working in a particular way with particular hopes of really changing her world. An example of an Israeli, interesting one, is Meir Margalit, who I was drawn to because he's an unusual combination of politician and activist. He's a Jerusalem municipal councillor, elected to that position with the Meretz party, which is left of center. And there are some administrative things he can do in that position that he couldn't otherwise, to do with the way permits are issued and demolition orders are issued. But he recognizes very clearly the limitations of working in the system that way, increasing limitations, in fact. And therefore, he's also a field coordinator for the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Now, there's tens of thousands of people's Palestinian homes have been destroyed over the years, and there are lists, actually government lists now, of tens of thousands more which are due for demolition. And although ostensibly the reason has been fighting terrorism, in fact what you see is a pattern of creating empty ground for settlements to be built and increased. So Meir's job, basically, is to try and prevent demolitions by getting activists to, particularly Israeli activists who are less likely to be shot at, to go and occupy houses that are slated for demolition, and also through the courts when possible. But as he said, the only way that we'll really change practice is by changing the policy, which, of course, is a huge undertaking. He also said that, I said, so how do you measure success then? And he said, well, the only way we can is to understand that regardless of what we accomplish or don't from moment to moment, since the house will eventually probably be demolished anyway, is to understand that this is something we have to do. We have no choice in the matter. And he actually cited the Talmud as a source for him of inspiration, in which the rabbis say something like, even though you may not see the results of your work, you do not have an excuse to stop working. So that's the kind of sustaining force there is for somebody like Meir.
One of the things in a lot of these struggles is international solidarity. How important is that for the grassroots activists and the people that are working on this kind of work in Israel and Palestine?
Absolutely vital. I was told often by people that they don't believe they have, Israelis particularly, they have the power to change how the course of things there. All they can do is keep doing what they're doing and try and alert people outside as much as possible to what's happening. And one of the probably the most powerful manifestations of that internationally is the BDS movement, Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, which is growing rapidly in many countries around the world. And I guess a measure of the impact it's beginning to have is the fact that Israeli government this year went from essentially ridiculing this as irrelevant and of no consequence to actually criminalizing support for BDS in Israel. And so that's one form. There are many others. Well, another example I can give you is that there's currently a law before the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, to ban donations to Israeli NGOs and human rights organizations from organizations like the European Union or the United Nations. And they aren't entirely dependent, but somewhat dependent now, to get information out and to do human rights research and to do organizing work, dependent on donations, as small NGOs usually are. So that's another example of the weight that the Israeli government puts on international support. Fine if you're supporting the settlers, new settlement construction and so on, but if you're advocating for peace in a meaningful way, a just way, then you're a target.
One of the things that's happening really worldwide now is there's sort of a lot of different protest movements and occupation movements. What kinds of parallels and lessons do you think these movements can learn from the groundwork that has been laid in Israel and Palestine?
I think one of the vital things about these movements you're describing is that they're all learning from each other. There's a wonderful quote yesterday from Dr. Mazim Kumsia, who's a longtime Palestinian activist. He's one of the freedom riders who tried to board the segregated buses in Israel this week. And he said, when he heard of the New York City government expelling under sort of militaristic police tactics the Occupy Wall Street folks, he said, the Intifada is finally going global. Now, from their point of view, Palestinians' point of view, I'll get to the other side of your question in a second, but from the Palestinians' point of view, I think it's very moving to see that they've been extremely isolated for a long time and operating in a shadow, in a way. And now I think that the awareness that's growing very rapidly about Palestine and as an occupied people is really making a lot of headway in the world. Now, about your question, what are people learning? I think right now is a very powerful time in Palestine for nonviolent resistance. Several people I spoke to explained that when they faced the choice of taking up a gun and shooting, that they chose what in a way is a more difficult choice, as one activist, Mohammed Khatib, said. It's actually more dangerous when you tie yourself to a tree, an olive tree, to prevent it being cut down, and you wait for the army to come, because you could be killed. And you're essentially not defending yourself. That's part of the approach to nonviolent resistance. Whereas he said, if you take up a gun and shoot and run away, maybe you'll be killed, but you don't face right there and then somebody with a machine gun right in your face.
Well, I want to thank you very much for speaking with me this morning.
Great. Okay, thank you, Manuel.
Thanks very much. Yeah. I have been speaking with author Michael Riordan. His recent book is titled Our Way to Fight, Peacework Under Siege in Israel-Palestine. He will be on a speaking tour of some cities in BC this week. He'll be speaking in Nanaimo on Wednesday, the 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Nanaimo Harborfront Library. And then he'll be here in Vancouver Thursday, November 24th at 7 p.m. speaking at Simon Fraser Harbor Center, room 1430. And depending on how things go this week at Occupy Vancouver, he'll be speaking there at the Art Gallery Friday, November 25th at 3 p.m.